Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth. Alaska may not be a huge farming state, but Alaska is full of food, and not only for meat eaters. The woods and beaches are rich in edible plants and fungus that can be delicious and not difficult to find. As we're going to learn on today's show, many of Alaska's edible plants are extremely common and preparation is easy. In the second half of the show, we'll be talking about the banner year for mushrooms that we're having in late summer and fall of 2016. There may never be a better time to learn to gather your own mushrooms, and I'll be talking to an expert about finding ones that are safe and good to eat, and we'll get a fascinating science lesson on mushrooms as well. My first guest is Leslie Shallcross, who is Associate Professor of Extension in Health, Home, and Family Development, University of Alaska Fairbanks, an extension person, extension agent, and she helps members of the public use the knowledge that the university has developed about many things, including different kinds of foods. And one of the neat things, Leslie, is that we live in this place with all this wild land that is really full of food, right? I mean, there's all kinds of plants that are edible and that are useful, and I think that we don't recognize a lot of those things as we're walking through the forest.
Right. It's very true. And in recent years, there really has been a increased interest in looking at local plants and looking at other things we might be harvesting from the forest or the beaches in Alaska. I am more familiar in some ways with foraging from the East Coast, which is where, you know, where I spent my youth and my early adulthood. And I used to go to, you know, foraging classes and we'd go out. And some of those same plants are here. There are certainly a lot of plants. If you look into some of the literature outlining uses by indigenous people in Alaska, you'll find a lot of uses of plants that grow here. And
that you may or may not find to be to your taste. Some of those things
you may or may not find to your taste.
But it's fun to find out,
If I had to sum it up, I would say most wild plants that we're not used to taste a little green and perhaps a little bit bitter, a little bit astringent. I'm not saying that's a bad thing, but that's probably what your experience would be. Of course, not unlike spinach or asparagus or cucumber,
anything you've raised to been raised to eat, you find familiar and tastes good to you. Anything that's new, it takes some familiarity before you like it. There's a plant called beach greens, which grows all over the shore in South Central Alaska, which people use for salads. I don't know if you should eat a huge amount of it, but certainly pick it up and eat it. And it's one of those things that tastes good, but then it has sort of a little iodine taste or something. And
right. You certainly are going to find seaweeds or plants that are growing by the ocean to have a hint of brininess to them. Certainly the seaweeds are very kind of briny tasting, but even those beach grass and things like that are going to have.
And the way to find out, I guess, greens. Is to try them. Although the first thing that we should probably talk about is knowledge. And that's one of the neat things about learning about plants as you go into the forest, is that having knowledge about what you're seeing greatly enhances your experience of the forest. And then knowing what the things taste like will enhance it even more. But knowing what's safe to eat is probably the most important thing of all before you get into this.
Right. Yeah. And I definitely recommend for anyone who is planning to go out and harvest that they get a good guide. We have a book at Extension that was produced quite a while ago, and we've been working on revising it so that the pictures are a little bit better. But Extension has a book called Wild Edible and Poisonous Plants of Alaska. There are a number of other books.
How can people find that particular book?
If they call the Extension office, they can request it, or if they go online, they can request it.
We'll have that website on ours. So you go to alaskapublic.org and click on today's show, Foraging. You'll find all the websites we're talking about, including the one for Leslie's organization.
a number of tribal organizations have produced really nice books. Remember, we talked with Sue Unger mm-hmm. about the book that they had done with the Aleutian and Pribilof mm-hmm. Islands Association. Yep. There's a book called Plants That We Eat from the Inupiat Elders of Northwest Alaska. That's a nice one. Of course, one person that we've heard of a lot, Janice Schofield, mm-hmm. Has produced several different books, and she's considered to be quite an expert. There's a traditional food guide for cancer survivors that was produced at Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium. Edible plants used by Siberian Yupik Eskimo.
I haven't seen that one.
So there's a lot of books that have been produced, some of them relatively recently. Janice Schofield has been known as an expert in wild plants for a long time. Some of these other books are newer, but you definitely want to get a book that has good pictures, know what you're doing.
And it's portable, because you really want it with you when you're out.
Yes.
And this is something where maybe the phone is not really ready, because I doubt that all this material is available online in a handy way.
Right. And if you can, see if you can find a class. I have not offered these classes in Anchorage, but out in Palmer and Wasilla, the extension agent who has the same position that I do takes people on wild plant walks. Our agent in Juneau is taking people on wild harvesting walks, so that you can actually see the plants. It's, you know, even if you've got good pictures, it's oftentimes hard to tell what's the exact color, or what's the exact size, or what's the exact shape, and how woody is the stem, and that kind of thing.
Right.
Seeing the plants is really the best way to get.
I learned that lesson myself. My mother used to pick fiddlehead ferns and make various things out of them, and I thought, wow, these are delicious. And then after she passed away, I thought, well, I'm going to do that too. And I went and gathered a bunch of ferns, but unfortunately I gathered the wrong kind of ferns, the wood ferns, and they were so chewy and fibrous that they were impossible to eat.
Wow.
So you kind of have to really have that knowledge right there. Maybe a friend is showing you the way, and you really have the resources to find what you're looking for.
Yes, and you if you're planning to do this, you have to know before the plants are up and before they're ready.
Mm-hmm.
You have to find out where those places are and continue to go back until you see them sprouting or see them at the ripest stage that you want them to be at.
Right. So it's not at all like just going to the grocery store. That's what's so special about it, is that there's a challenge and there's some preparation and some knowledge that's required.
Well, and it's for many of these things, there's no other way that you would get them.
Right.
Other than going out and getting them yourself.
Well, right here in our area, give me a couple of examples of plants that you can seek. I mean, I know Labrador tea is like one that everybody learns about, that is an easy to identify plant that you can make tea out of, and it's medicinal. I don't know. I've never done it myself.
I don't think I've made it. I've certainly had it, but not made it. But some of the things that you might find in South Central that would be edible, the beech greens that you mentioned, mm-hmm. You can
very
find.
Very common.
Yep. Beech lovage is a plant that you can eat. Chickweed.
Oh, really?
I didn't. I have a little patch beside my townhouse that I haven't put anything into, and it's covered with chickweed right now.
It takes off. It's like the first thing to take over. Yeah.
Yeah. Dandelions.
So what would you, just as an example, do you know what you would do with chickweed?
I would rinse it,
mm-hmm.
And you could eat it raw, or you could just steam it, cook mm-hmm. it a little bit, cook it in with some spinach, things like
okay.
that. Chickweed is pretty mild tasting to my taste buds. It doesn't have a strong flavor, so
neat.
Yeah, you don't have to do anything fancy to it. Just add it to your other greens.
Dandelions are not native, are they? I mean, are they invasive?
There are invasive dandelions. There are some native dandelions.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah. But no problem with harvesting those non-native ones.
Right.
In fact, maybe it's a good idea.
Do you know what you would do with them?
Dandelion greens, again, could be eaten raw in a salad or cooked or blanched and frozen.
Okay, neat.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, I keep interrupting you, but go ahead.
Devil's club buds can actually be eaten, but again...
Early spring.
Yeah. That would be something you'd do early before the plant gets hard spines on it.
They grow so fast, it's amazing.
Yeah. You know, I haven't seen nettles here, although they definitely grow here. That's something I'm very familiar with from the east.
I think they're more common in southeast Alaska.
They're more common in the southeast, yep. Nettles are a plant that's highly nutritious, has more protein than some other plants. Let's see, what else? You know, fireweed is something that the whole plant can be used, but in the spring we use the roots, the early shoots. Sometimes people call them like asparagus, but the fireweed can be used. The leaves can actually be used, and the flowers can be used.
Oh, neat!
Now, we're heading into fall here, and fireweed is
pretty much done. Yeah.
On its way out, although not totally.
Show will be archived, so all of our shows, folks can go back and listen to it in the spring.
Yeah. So. And Extension has some resources for talking about using wild fireweed. One thing that I didn't mention, we also have roses, lots of wild roses, and the flower petals from roses can be used, and also the rose hip.
Oh, that's a fall thing.
Which sometimes we lump in with berries.
Mm-hmm. What do you do with the rose hips?
Rose hips are, highly nutritious. They contain lycopene. They're very, very high in vitamin C.
Wow.
And rose hips can be dried, or they can be harvested and kind of cooked down into a puree, and then you can freeze that puree and keep it. Or one thing that I really like to do is to turn that into a fruit leather.
Neat.
Makes a wonderful fruit leather.
One of the neat things about some of these plants you've mentioned, and you probably have a lot more to mention, and I welcome you to do that, is that some of them are extremely common, not difficult to find, and would be hard to probably over-harvest, but others probably you do need to be somewhat careful about over-harvesting.
Yeah, one of the things that I think is really important when people get excited about harvesting and using wild plants is that they, first of all, that you know what you're doing,
right?
That you can clearly identify the plants, and once you bring it home, take a good look at it again, and make sure.
Be 100% sure.
Yeah,
right.
Be 100% sure. You want to definitely be respectful in your harvesting methods, so that we know that these plants are sustainable. You don't want to destroy the plant. You don't want to take too many of them in one spot, because you definitely want them to come back. They're food for us. They're food for probably animals, and they're part of that ecosystem that they're in. And we never do anybody any good if we over harvest.
Absolutely. And there's an aesthetic quality to that too. I mean, if let's leave it so that it doesn't look like the place has been torn up, and the next person who comes along gets to have a positive feeling when they're there too.
Yeah, right. Another thing that you want to be careful about as you're harvesting is that you're you're not taking them in places where there may be pollution of different sorts, mm-hmm. either from from fuel exhaust or if they're growing near the ocean or a stream. You want to make sure that water supply is clean,
right,
before you take them.
Get a little bit away from the road.
Yeah. Yep. And also, when you bring them home, you want to think about making sure that they're cleaned appropriately.
Right. Well, let's get into that some more in a minute, but I want to make sure everybody knows this is Outdoor Explorer. We're talking about foraging today, and a big topic, a lot to learn, and kind of a fun thing where you can sort of make use, next time you go on a hike, you can actually use some of the interesting things you find with some preparation, some knowledge, and some care. And my guest is Leslie Shawcross. She's Associate Professor of Extension in Health, Home and Family Development, University of Alaska Fairbanks. And Leslie's been kind enough to come in once again and share some of this super valuable knowledge. And you can call up your extension agent. I've done it just to ask questions, and it's really useful, and it's something that is provided by the university and also by federal funding to have these folks here to give us this knowledge. You can find that information on our website at alaskapublic.org or at outdoorexplorer.org and click on today's show on foraging. And so, Leslie, just a quick side note, I guess the extension office in Anchorage is expected to close this fall on October 30th and move up to Fairbanks. I guess your material will still be available online.
Right. You know, we don't know exactly what the plans are for the future of extension in Anchorage. The physical office that we occupy, which is on 16th and C Street right now, will be closed. There is the potential for there to be some other sort of office in Anchorage, but the faculty in the extension office right now have been relocated. I'll be moving to Fairbanks, and Julie Riley will be moving to Fairbanks, and our 4-H person will be moving to Soldotna. So those will be our base offices. Mm. Hopefully we'll be able to continue to serve Anchorage with some of the same things that we're doing, but maybe some other things and maybe some things online. People will still be able to get answers to questions that, I take a lot of calls, food safety, right, cleaning, foraging, identifying berries, that kind of thing. We'll still be able to do that. In addition, we have an office in Palmer, and faculty there hopefully will be able to help with some of the some of the needs of the Anchorage area.
All right. Well, and we're recording in the summer of 2016 and be on the air in the early fall, and the show will be available online for a long time. So who knows where you're at when people are hearing it?
Right.
I had an experience a few years ago in which a well-meaning friend picked up some seaweed and said, "Well, this is good to eat." Gave some to my daughter. He ate some. Next morning, the phone rang. How's she doing? Is Becky okay? Because it turned out this was not appropriate to eat.
Not a good beach.
She was fine, but it was a species that was really not supposed to be eaten. And he was ill for the day. And it certainly taught me a lesson. Are there plants out there that are really terribly dangerous in Alaska?
You know, there are a couple of plants that are pretty toxic. One is a berry. I mean, the one that we always think about when we think about what's the very worst thing you could do would be to eat a baneberry.
Mm.
And baneberry could be, although an adult is almost 100% likely to identify that, a child may not. And baneberry comes in white and red. The berry looks just about identical, but the color is different. So they could be really attractive. I got a call last week from some families. They were like, our 2 year old ate something. It turned out to be red huckleberry, which is not recommended to eat either, but doesn't have the extreme neurotoxicity of the baneberry.
So it's really a serious poison then.
It is, yeah. There are a few others. There's a wild hemlock that is dangerous. It's a water hemlock. There Narcissus flowered anemone. I'm not sure.
Great name.
Yeah. I probably wouldn't eat it, but...
Bottom line is it you need to be positively informed that what you are eating is good to eat, because
yes.
There's stuff out there that's really seriously not good to eat.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And there are a couple other wild plants. I don't know if you remember, there were some youngsters who had gone out and they were trying to survive on plants, and they ate one that was pretty toxic. So you can't eat just any plants.
Right. This idea of just go out in the woods and figure it out is not going to work. It's really not a sustainable or a sensible thing to do. You need to have the knowledge and preparation.
Yeah. There's a plant called false hellebore that's has very broad, kind of nice looking leaves. Don't eat that if you're trying to survive when you're lost. There's a plant called the death Commas.
Good name.
Right.
it should tell you something.
Should tell you something, but you might not recognize it.
Mm-hmm.
So there are a lot of plants.
Yeah.
Fortunately, most of the plants are not going to kill you.
Make you feel horrible.
Feel horrible. The baneberry has a neurotoxin. Most of the other plants are going to give you an upset stomach. Most of these things aren't going to get you right away, or if you don't eat a lot of it.
Mm-hmm.
Baneberry, right. A couple baneberries can be enough to really harm a child.
Wow.
So.
All right, well, let's talk about getting your harvest home. And most of these things, it sounds like, are things you probably eat the same day or in a couple of days, not necessarily things you would be putting up for the entire winter.
Right. So, different traditions have used plants differently. Coming from Extension, where I'm trying to use always obligated to use research-based preservation methods when I talk about them with people. So there are methods of preserving greens and plants that we do not have research on. People have fermented them.
Mm.
They have dried them. They have put them in oil.
Mm-hmm.
From my Extension background and from the research that I have, most of these wild plants, I do not have safe methods of storing them. The only recommendation that I would have for storing most plants would be the same way I would handle a vegetable, and that would be you could probably safely blanch them, which gets rid of the enzymes and also gets rid of some bacteria that may be on the outside of the plant. And then you can freeze it,
Which in some cases will have good results and some won't.
Right. I don't really know.
Probably a matter of experimentation.
Right, right. And these are, of course, again, we're talking about plants that you may or may not have a preference for. So it's a good... If you're planning to do some foraging, thinking this is going to provide you with some food security or some extra nutrients that you might not otherwise get, make sure that you like the taste of this plant.
Start small.
Make sure that you like the taste of it. Also, make sure that you don't have a reaction to it.
Well,
just
right.
Like
so you
with,
harvest a little bit, yep. Try it, see what happens if you freeze it.
Yep.
Right.
Just like with other plants or foods, we
you
may have
allergic.
we may have allergic reactions to things. I was just talking with one of my brothers who's a physician, and he had identified a rash that's extremely rare, but it was actually a response to a shiitake mushroom.
Oh wow.
You know, when we start eating things that aren't things that we may normally be eating, we may find that we have a reaction to them.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, this was a indication of an allergic response.
Now, when we get into berries, and we've mostly been focusing on other kinds of foraging, but when you get into berries, then there are recipes where you can safely make those into jams and jellies and can them.
Yes. Yep. Berries, because of their, you know, that their tanginess, that's mm-hmm. acid, and that acid both helps preserve them, but it also makes them a little bit safer. And because berries are pretty popular with us, mm-hmm. We have researched how to use them, and they can be dried, and they can be frozen, they can be made into fruit leather, they can be juiced.
As you mentioned, also the rose hips, which are kind of
right.
in the berry category. A little
right.
Bit. Yeah.
Right.
So, and getting that, now, again, that's something you need to learn how to do. You need a cookbook, you need sort of the right equipment, you need to make sure the equipment is working properly.
You know, if you want the product to be good,
mm-hmm.
you really should follow methods that we know of to preserve them properly. And again, there are probably traditional methods, and some of those books that I talked about mm-hmm. have, you know, the traditional ways of handling these things. Again, they may be drying, they may be fermenting, they may be putting them in oil, some things like that. So make sure that you're using methods that we know are going to be safe. And there's a word of caution even on some of the traditional methods, because
right.
traditional methods have relied upon a climate or weather that is cooler. We may not come up with the same things
right.
these days.
You hear about village folks having trouble drying their fish because it's too rainy, it's too wet.
Too rainy, too wet, too warm.
Too warm, too many flies, that kind of thing.
Yep, yeah. And again, you know, when you're putting things in oil, you have to remember that botulism is a risk.
Mm-hmm.
Unless it's cold enough that you can't.
One of the things that I found interesting when we spoke before is that as a cook, as a family cook, you're probably used to experimenting and trying different things and throwing in different flavors. But when you're canning and preserving food, you kind of have to not experiment so much in terms of those factors that are going to keep the food safe for a long time.
Right.
So it has to be to the right temperature. You have to have the right pressure. Those are not negotiable.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. And that information can be found on your website and from some of these books that we've
yes.
talked about.
Yes.
Yes. Well, this has been fascinating. It went by really, really quickly. My guest has been Leslie Shallcross, who's Associate Professor of Extension in Health, Home, and Family Development, and she's connected to the University of Alaska Fairbanks. And the websites we've been talking about are available at outdoorexplorer.org. Click on today's show, Foraging. We'll try to have some of the titles of some of those books there, too. Thanks so much for being with us, Leslie.
Oh, you're welcome.
Stick with us as Outdoor Explorer continues. It's Outdoor Explorer. We're talking about food that you can find foraging in the woods for plants and mushrooms on today's show. I'm Charles Wolforth. Thanks for joining us on KSKA Anchorage. In this last half of the show, we're going to hear a lot about mushrooms with a real expert who has some great insight about them. But first, here's something about someone who doesn't know so much about mushrooms, Heidi Dreigas. She's a commissioner of the Alaska Department of Labor and Workforce, and she's a food blogger. She's not afraid to try Alaska foods, but she hadn't yet tried mushrooms when Alaska Public Media's Dave Waldron caught up with her in 2014.
Now, you may have heard radio stories about mushroom foragers or mushroom experts, but Heidi Dragas is neither of those. Dragas writes the food blog China Girl Cooks, and she's harvested just about everything Alaska has to offer. But mushrooms have always been the last thing on her list.
I think a lot of people are afraid of it, for obvious reasons, because if you don't do it right, you can die.
Dragas has finally decided to give mushroom foraging a try, and she's settled on a ski trail in the South Anchorage area for her location. As this is her first official hunt, she is narrowing her search to a very common, very safe mushroom.
We're just going to try to find a very plentiful mushroom in Alaska called boletes. And they are the easiest to identify as far as I'm concerned.
Boletes are large and brown with a domed cap. The mushroom guides that Dragas has brought along say that under the cap, you should see a coral-like texture. If you see a gilled accordion-like texture underneath, you probably shouldn't eat it.
Oh, look at this one. Let's see what this is. Oh my God, is this not the cutest little mushroom you ever saw? It has gills, so we're not going to eat it, but it's like the perfect mushroom.
Once we venture off the main trail, we find an abundance of mushrooms, but none that we think we can eat.
And it's like a boon for mushrooms, but for edible ones, it's kind of slim pickings.
We do manage to find a single bolete, but it looks like something's been chewing on it. Also, it's rotting. After about 30 minutes with an empty basket, I'm thinking the only mushrooms we'll be eating will be from the grocery store. And then...
there is a pretty little bolete.
That's perfect.
Isn't that perfect? It is.
It's plump and it hasn't been eaten by an animal.
Exactly.
No gills.
We don't have to go to cars and find mushrooms.
Picking mushrooms is totally like fishing. You snag a great one and you're pumped, but then 30 minutes later you're complaining how dead it is. That is until you find the mother load.
Holy
They're everywhere.
Crap.
Okay, let's identify what these are.
These don't look like boletes, but we're hoping they're at least edible.
Yeah, I think that might be the oyster. Oh.
Oh.
False chanterelle.
Oh,
that's
good.
What it is.
That looks perfect.
That looks like a false chanterelle, yep. Which sounds like it's not
edible.
Edibility unknown.
And flipping through Dragas' mushroom guides, we notice a lot of these mushrooms have some serious ambiguity.
A lot of these say edible with caution. That does not inspire confidence. Edible, but you may feel really bad afterwards.
And that might be yet another reason why a lot of people are too freaked out to pick mushrooms. Still, we decide if we limit ourselves to just boletes, we're going to end this trip with a single mushroom. So we track down one other fairly common, mostly edible mushroom.
So, this one is smooth. This is the gemmed puffball. So I think that's what these are. They look like them, don't they?
Oh yeah.
And they say they're edible for most people.
Edible for most people is going to have to do it, because it's starting to get dark outside. But we do have a small bounty we can be proud of. And besides,
it's way more fun than going to the grocery store. I mean, it's in your backyard. It's down the trail. It's, you know, you can see these things growing in the middle of the woods and in the parking lot.
When I ask Dragas if she'll be coming back for more mushrooms, she guarantees it. She says a handful of mushrooms isn't bad for a first-timer, but she's already hungry for more. I'm Dave Waldron.
We're back. It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth. Today we're talking about food that you can find out in the wilderness or even by the roadside or the side of the trail, foraging for plants and fungus and whatever else might interest you. There's a lot to eat in Alaska's woods. And for this half, we're going to focus on mushrooms and fungus. Kate Mowat is with me. She's an ecologist with the Tugatch National Forest. And has studied this from a scientific standpoint, and you're a Gerd Wadovian as well.
That's right. Yeah. I also spent a lot of time in Cordova.
Uh-huh. Yeah, and you're going to be speaking at the Cordova Fungus Festival, which is coming up September 2nd and 4th. That'll be right after we're broadcasting our show for the first time. If you're listening to the repeat, it's already taken place, but there will still be plenty of mushrooms out in the woods probably. This has been kind of an amazing year for mushrooms, it seems. Every time I turn around, there are more of them, and I'm wondering what is causing that? What are the conditions that caused mushrooms to be taken off this year?
So a big one, obviously, is rain. Another big contributing factor is the last couple years prior, if you recall, were very dry, very drought almost in some areas. Girdwood, which is, you know, the northernmost rainforest in North America, was powdery dry in late August when it should have been getting rain starting around late July, which we got this year, right on schedule. And so I've been using the term, there's been a lot of pent-up mycelium down there. Mycelium is the fungal threads that produce the mushrooms or the fruit bodies. And so it's been a couple years of no mushrooms, and now they finally got that burst of moisture that they've been needing at the right time of year to really take off. And so I think that's why we're seeing so many. Another big component to that with the moisture is the sunny weather we've had, the nice summers we've had the last couple of years. A lot of the mushrooms you're seeing coming out now are, they form these symbiotic relationships with the trees, birch, aspen, conifer. They all have mushrooms or fungi actually growing on their roots, and they rely on those fungi for growth and survival, and the fungi rely on their host tree for their carbohydrates. So you can see a good summer with lots of sun and then moisture falling. The trees are happy. That means the fungi are getting more sugar and can produce more mushrooms.
Wow. So this might be not just something that's just because we had a rainy period, but this could be like a bumper crop year for mushrooms over a number of years.
Absolutely. I think, yeah, this is a big year as a result of
all these different factors you're mentioning. Does it do these positive conditions affect all mushrooms equally?
That's a tough question. I would say it really depends.
Okay. So it depends on like what different species need and what their microclimate is. I know there's some that like forest fires.
Exactly. You know. Yeah. So we actually had a bumper crop for morels this spring, which require a forest fire the year before. Well, our morels do. Lower 48 morels are different species, and they aren't necessarily fire dependent. But
we had a lot of fires the previous year.
Right.
So
and moisture again at the right time a year later is what allowed these huge fruitings.
Huh. So and so the McHugh Creek fire down on the turning an arm, like next spring maybe there'd be a lot of mushrooms.
Potentially.
Possibly.
It all depends on when the moisture comes.
Uh-huh.
And if there's enough of it and if it burned at the right intensity and
what is it that makes the morels. Oh, you know, what about a fire makes the morels want to grow there?
Well, it's kind of a million-dollar question, and I haven't kept up on the latest research there, but I know some theory. Morels really like disturbance, and the thought is that they're in the soil. They've been there for years waiting for that big release from the fire. Another theory is, well, they're maybe their mycorrhizal, as I was referring to earlier, you know, having this mutual symbiosis with the tree. And when the tree dies in a fire, say, that might be giving them their signal to produce a mushroom to get their spores out into the environment and into new places.
This whole thing is making me realize that I'm very, very ignorant, and which is always fun because it means I get to learn new stuff. And I bet a lot of listeners are in the same boat. It's like, what is a mushroom exactly? I mean, let's take it like, where is, they're not getting their energy from the sun. They're getting their energy from decay, right?
Exactly. Not just decay, but also from living organisms. That's a great question. I generally start my presentations off with what's a mushroom, because historically they were lumped with plants. Mm-hmm. And but as you mentioned, they don't have chlorophyll. They don't get their nutrients from the sun. They get it from the environment, much like we do. So they, it turns out, are more closely related to animals than plants. They, as you mentioned, can be decomposers. They can break down, they're the only organism that can break down tough woody debris found in trees, lignin and cellulose, for example. They're also, they form these mutualistic symbioses where they get all of their nutrients and food from trees through their sugars and photosynthates. And then they can also be pathogens. And a lot of folks are aware of anybody who tries to grow anything. I got a lot of fungus on my begonias this year, for example. They can attack living tissue as well.
And that's essentially they're being parasitic there, where they're just eating the begonias, gathering up the energy from the sun, and then the fungus is just stealing it, essentially.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And then there's this huge gray area as well, where some species will tap into the mycorrhizal network of a plant and a fungus, and there's some shady gray areas that aren't quite teased out yet as to what's going on.
Huh. It's really interesting. I remember talking to a scientist who's studying the soil biome and the all the different organisms that are there in this super complex web that we never think of. It's just under our feet.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
A tremendous amount of diversity. So fungi are the second most diverse group of organisms, second only to insects.
Wow.
There's an estimated 1.5 million species worldwide, but there's very few mycologists. There's a lot more entomologists, so we just have very few species described compared to what's really out there diversity-wise.
And when you're out in the woods, you're looking for new species?
Oh, we find new species.
Like every time you turn around?
Almost.
Wow.
And a lot of it actually has to do with quite a few of our species in North America have European names. A lot of our early mycologists came over from Europe, and they described these species that they were calling the same thing that they would see in Europe. But through DNA and sequencing, we can now determine that they are, in fact, different species. So quite a few new species are being described just from that.
So what I need you to define a term that you were using just a minute ago, mycorrhizomal?
Mycorrhizae.
Okay.
So that's the root fungus symbiosis between all of our trees, except for maybe yellow cedar, but they form a different type of mycorrhizal association. But all of our trees, quite a few of our herbaceous plants form these mutualistic associations with fungi. And the fungi will grow on their roots, on the root tips, and that's where you get your exchange of nutrients. The fungal mycelium
So that's a little bit similar to where we have bacteria in the gut that helps us get energy out of food. The plants have fungus on their roots that helps them get energy or nutrients out of the soil.
Yes, that's correct.
Neat.
And it's hypothesized that that's how plants were able to evolve to tolerate terrestrial environments, was because they had initially that fungi providing them an anchor and keeping them from drying out.
So fungus came first.
Possibly.
Maybe.
I think concurrently, but.
Very cool. Well, we're talking about fungus today, getting a little bit more scientific than we usually do on Outdoor Explorer, but I can't help it because it's really interesting. My guest is Kate Moat, who's an ecologist with Chugach National Forest, and she's going to be speaking September at the Cordova Fungus Festival, September 2nd through 4th. If you're listening to our show on the first airing, there's just barely time to get down there and participate in the Fungus Festival, which sounds like this year will be a banner year for it because we've had so much rain and there are so many mushrooms out there. Well, I was a little bit avoiding it because as soon as you start talking about mushrooms, you immediately get into what's poisonous, what's not poisonous, how to identify them and all that. But it's kind of an important topic.
Right.
And I know that we're probably whetting the appetite of some of our listeners to go out and find mushrooms that they can eat. That's part of our goal. What percentage of the mushrooms that we have in Alaska or that you would find in the woods are actually yummy and that you'd want to pick and eat? It's a lot of them?
A well-phrased question, because a majority of mushrooms found in Alaska are technically edible, meaning you can eat them and you probably won't get sick.
Mm-hmm.
A majority of these also fall in the category of edibility unknown, meaning not everybody has been a guinea pig. And the reason why is because most of them are pretty tasteless, or they're tiny, or their texture is so woody such that you wouldn't want to consume them.
Mm.
So as far as choice edible species go up here, you're looking at about 5% of the species, 2 to 5%. That's generous.
Wow.
It's a very small amount. But what we're seeing this year is a huge amount of biomass of choice edible mushrooms. While you have very few species, you have a huge abundance of these quite good edibles that are out all over Alaska, from what I can tell from social media.
Hmm. So give me the names of some of the rock star mushrooms in Alaska.
Well, my personal favorite is the porcini, or king bolete, or boletus edulis in Latin. Porcini is the Latin name, and probably one that most
people know how to cook with that. Yeah.
Yeah, and it is a huge year for that one. We didn't see it much last year. Saw it 2 years ago, quite late in the year. But that one is delicious fresh, delicious dried. I've been pickling them. There's just so many variety of things you can do with that one. Another really common.
Where would you find them? Is it a particular kind of
in
habitat?
In the woods.
Well, you don't have to give me your secret spot, but I mean, is there a type of microclimate where they'd be more likely to be found?
Yes. So they like conifers specifically. Mm. You'll find them with spruce, hemlock, and all over South Central, really. Mm-hmm. I'm seeing a lot of them in Southeast as well.
Okay.
And once you get into the hardwood country, birch and aspen, you start to find lexinums, or birch aspen boletes. There's a huge diversity of species in that group that are closely related to king boletes, and quite a few people eat them and find them desirable. I would be in the category that don't appreciate their culinary value, but that's just me. I tend to be pickier than most.
You're a person who studies mushrooms, but they're not your favorite food.
Right. Okay. I never liked to eat them as a kid.
Okay. So how would listeners figure out what these particular, the porcini and the other one you just mentioned, what they look like,
so they can seek
them?
So the boletes have pores under their cap. They have the traditional mushroom shape with a cap and stem, but they have a pore underneath, and they're soft and fleshy. They grow on the ground. They're very easy to identify.
Okay.
And we do have a number of species of boletes in that category. So it's definitely advisable that you become familiar with that group if that's what you're seeking. King boletes are pretty easy to identify because when you cut them in half, they're white. They don't stain any color. They're big, fleshy. They've got a cap that looks like a hamburger bun. They're called, I can't remember the name in England, but it's something similar to penny bun, I think is what it is. And the lexinums, or the birch aspen boletes, they're also called scaber stalks, are their common name, and they have these black tick marks on their stalk that are very distinctive. Their cap colors can range from orange to dull brown to splotchy brown.
Okay. I'm just feeling like if I were going to seek these and eat them, I would really want a picture and a written description so that I can make sure that I got the right one, or somebody who'd already picked them.
Right. And so there's actually a great free resource with all of our, in my opinion, choice edibles for this region. The Forest Service publication called Mushrooms of the National Forests of Alaska. Mm. Steve Trudell and I, and Karen Dillman, who's the ecologist down on the Tongass, wrote this brochure. It's got 51 species with photos, colored photos, descriptions. And it's free. You can get it online in PDF form, or you can pick it up. You can pick it up at any Forest Service office in the state.
Or the Public Lands Information Center downtown, probably.
They might have it, yeah. We tend to send them a box or two every year.
Okay. Well, we're going to put a link to that on our website at outdoorexplorer.org. Just click on today's show about foraging, and you will find that PDF to my guest's brochure. Kate Mowat is an ecologist with Chugach National Forest. What about the porcinis? What do those look like?
As I mentioned, they're just, they're also in Italian, their name means little piggy. So I always scream little piggy when I see one, but they have a very bulbous stem and then the, hamburger bun like cap.
Okay.
The pore surface underneath is white when young, and when it matures, it turns a yellow turning to almost a dark green color with age. And when they get to that stage, at least what we're finding this year is not only is it a good year for mushrooms because of the rain, it's been a great year for slugs. And slugs, I think their favorite edible is also the porcini.
Yuck.
I found three giant slugs on this perfect-looking porcini just about 2 hours ago. And Yeah.
losing my appetite.
I'm sorry.
So you said there aren't a lot of poisonous mushrooms, but there are certainly some. And do we have mushrooms here that'll just kill you? Or
absolutely, we do. Yeah. And okay. In fact, so it's a little brown mushroom. Now I'm blanking on the common name. The deadly Gallerina autumnalis, or marginata as it used to be known. And it's actually very common in wood chips in the fall and anywhere you've done some landscaping. It's all over my yard. Hmm. The only people that tend to get in trouble with that one are people who are looking for hallucinogenic mushrooms, which grow in a similar habitat and have a similar stature and appearance.
Huh.
But that one is absolutely deadly poisonous. It's one of those that can cause liver failure over a couple of weeks' time, and certainly should be avoided.
How do you know if you've eaten one of these poisonous mushrooms?
Well, first of all, you should never eat anything that you don't know what it is.
Yeah, understand.
If you don't have a good Latin name for it, don't eat it.
Mm-hmm.
And be very, very confident in your right. identification. Not just what you think it is, but you should also be familiar with all the lookalikes.
Right. So, but if you were starting to feel sick, it could be because the food wasn't prepared properly, or it could be because you made a mistake.
Exactly. Or it could be that you have an intolerance to mushrooms, which quite a few people do.
Mm.
Mushrooms, as we mentioned, they're not plants, they're not animals. Mm-hmm. They have chitin in their cell walls. Chitin's also found in insect exoskeletons.
Huh.
So another reason why we say always cook your mushrooms, even the store-bought ones, because they're very difficult to digest with that chitin. And when you cook them thoroughly, you'll break that down, you'll get some nutrients out of them, and hopefully have an easier time digesting them.
Interesting.
If you eat enough mushrooms, virtually anyone will get some sort of gastronomic distress.
Okay.
And so on that note, if you're not sure about what you're eating, it's really advisable to save a sample of what you ate, even if you're confident. But if you're trying it for the first time, that way, if you do have an adverse reaction, you can get that sample to me, or there's others in Anchorage, like Diane Planinger, who can identify these for you. And we'll, hopefully if you're not in a hospital type situation, maybe assist the doctors, because there's a variety of mushroom toxins, and the treatment for mushroom poisoning depends on what you ate.
Wow. So why are poisonous mushrooms poisonous? Is it a defensive mechanism? Is there any theory as to why they would have that adaptation?
I don't think it's necessarily to kill us, but I think it's just a different metabolite that they have. Fungi can decompose, as I mentioned earlier, such a wide variety of different things. So they produce all these different and novel and unique enzymes.
Mm-hmm.
Quite a few of them are terribly medicinal as well. A lot of our wood decomposing mushrooms have a lot of medicinal qualities.
So who knows?
So who knows?
The mysteries of nature.
And maybe somebody does. I'm just not read up on that.
Well, that's fine. You've already impressed me with your knowledge, so I'm not too worried about that. You were saying that before we started that social media has become a pretty important factor for mushroom hunting. What's happening in sort of social media, and how does that assist people who are looking for mushrooms?
Yeah, so what I've seen big time this year, and I know part of that is a function of the huge amount of mushrooms we have, but over the last couple of years there have become, these Alaskan mushroom hunting Facebook pages, and they've just been flooded the last couple of weeks. And I think it's encouraging a lot of new people to have always been interested in mushrooms to then, take a bunch of pictures, post them, put it out there and say, hey, what's this? And there are some folks on there that are very good about identifying these things. There's also quite a few folks that maybe shouldn't be commenting, but provide nefarious identifications anyway. It's uh-huh. just been very interesting.
So you've gone on there and you found false identifications.
Yes, quite a few.
Uh-huh. What do you do when that happens?
I tend to stay out of it.
Really?
Every now and then I'll correct, but it seems to be there's some other folks that have been self-policing and correcting, and they seem to be doing a good job of it. So
I have the feeling this sort of thing is becoming more and more popular. Do you agree?
I do. And, so one of our presenters last year was Dennis Benjamin. And so there's this fabulous publication, if you're a fungal enthusiast, called Fungi Magazine. It comes out every 4 months. He wrote this fantastic article on social media and mushrooms in their winter edition. And it's just absolutely appropriate. And I would love to post this in places. The hilarious thing, though, is that there's no digital version of it. Ah. It is in print form only.
Ironic, yeah.
But he talks about how what you see just all the time, either really poor photos or shaky photos, people providing identifications where maybe they're just brand new to mushrooming and really shouldn't be doing that.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway.
Well, becoming good at it sounds like it would take a while. And I know being an ecologist is one of the hardest sciences you can pursue because ecology is incredibly complex and takes just a great deal of patience to kind of learn the paths of energy and nutrients through the system. The ecologists right. I've spent time with tend to be very patient people. Does that describe you?
Maybe when it comes to something.
Yeah, when it comes to fungus, but not when it comes to people.
Right, maybe. yeah, after the 70th can I eat it question in a foray, maybe my patience wanes a little bit.
Uh-huh. Well, what do you try to, go ahead.
No, that's...
I was just going to say, and you are speaking down in Cordova, what do you try to get across to people in those kind of settings?
Well, so this would be the 10th year for the Cordova Fungus Festival, and a lot of the folks that come have been coming year after year, so we try to mix it up every year. And what's a really cool kind of side aspect of this, we tend to bring outside mycologists in from different specialties. And over the years, we've amassed this, you know, wonderful collection and species documentation of what's in the Cordova area and the Girdwood area with the Girdwood Fungus Fair. And so what I'm going to be talking about this year is rare and interesting finds from Cordova, things that we've found over the last 10 years that we don't see in Girdwood, in fact, that we don't see anywhere else in the state. There's now this, there has been this global red list initiative to identify and track rare species throughout the world, and fungi are way underrepresented there,
yeah.
And especially for North America, because we're still trying to figure out what it is that we have, first of all, let alone decide what may be rare.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a couple of species in Cordova, this Lactarius cordovaensis, for example, we only know from two locations in Cordova.
Wow.
And it's this big purple-ish mushroom. It's a milk cap, so when you cut the cap, it oozes this sort of white latex. And so it'd be hard to miss.
How awesome. So the natural world is so diverse that just a little tiny place could have its own species.
Yes.
That's really
neat. A little endemic. And I think there's huge possibilities for that up here where you have, you know, glaciers retreating mm-hmm. and advancing over tens of thousands of years. I think the possibilities of that happening or creating endemic populations is higher.
Very neat. Well, thank you so much, Kate Mowat. She's an ecologist with Chugach National Forest and knows everything there is to know about mushrooms.
I wouldn't go that far.
Well, at least a lot more than most of us. Thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
That's all for Outdoor Explorer today. Our assistant producer is Hannah Doro. She works on getting guests in the studio and does a great job. Eric Bork is our producer. My name is Charles Wolforth. Tune in again next week, and I'll see you outside.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. Theme music is by Portugal, The Man. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect the station or its underwriters. You can find Outdoor Explorer on Facebook and on iTunes. To see what's coming up on Outdoor Explorer and add your voice to the conversation, go to our website at alaskapublic.org.
Life informed. This is Alaska Public Media.